You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Tim.
Hey, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Can't complain. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. And you are Timothy B. Lee, author of the Understanding AI Newsletter, which I recommend to everyone. Now, I have a question for you. Did you you call yourself Timothy B. Lee in hopes that you'll be mixed up with Tim Berners-Lee, invented the World Wide Web, and you'll get good seats at restaurants?
Some people have accused me of pretending to be Tim Berners-Lee, but most people seem to be able to tell the difference between us. He's,
he's British.
He's older.
I interviewed him for several hours for a piece I did a long time ago on Time Magazine. Nice guy.
Really? No, I've never met him.
It was called
He seemed like a good guy.
I think the piece was called The Accidental Gutenberg because he had no idea what he was creating. Mm-hmm. He thought it was going to be this wonderful thing that was not going to be highly commercialized.
Right.
He didn't anticipate the commercialization part. So, anyway, there's a lot going on the AI front. We have these conversations every once in a while, you and I, and maybe not often enough because so much has happened. Only like in the last week or two, we've got the Elon OpenAI lawsuit, and there was a development on that only today with OpenAI, the key people at OpenAI replying. Anthropic released Claude 3. Anthropic being this company started by OpenAI expats who thought OpenAI wasn't taking safety seriously enough. Claude 3 seems to be a true rival to GPT-4, and you did a review of it in your newsletter, which people should check out. The other thing that is considered more or less a rival is the advanced version of Gemini. So now there's basically three kind of roughly comparable models. We can talk about all this and also maybe the hyper wokeness controversy with Google Gemini, which actually obscured some arguably more important news, which was good news from Google's point of view, which we can also talk about. Yeah. About certain powers that future models of Gemini are going to have. And I want to get back to, this is probably the oldest news of all maybe in this, but that Sora video thing that OpenAI unveiled a couple of weeks ago, at least, I still think is worth talking about. So we got a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
Should we start with a lawsuit? Or
yeah, I think that makes sense.
So what's your, I guess everybody knows that Elon, well, maybe they don't. So, you know, OpenAI was started with high ideals. It was a nonprofit originally. Now it has this for-profit subsidiary. Elon donated most of the money at the beginning. He feels the lawsuit says he was betrayed. They've sacrificed their ideals and gone for the profit. And so they, in some sense, maybe misrepresented themselves to him at the beginning. Sam Altman did or something. That's kind of the, I don't know what you'd add to that before you start elaborating, but.
Yeah, that's right. They Elon Musk co-founded OpenAI with Sam Altman and a few other people and was the main funder for the organization in the early years. At least that's how Elon Musk tells it. And they had this falling out in 2018. Elon Musk left. And then not that long after that, OpenAI did this deal with Microsoft that they created this for-profit subsidiary and raised a bunch of money through that from Microsoft, and since then have had much more of a commercial kind of feel. And Elon Musk is not happy about this and filed this lawsuit. And I don't know, like, I guess my big takeaway from this lawsuit is I'm not sure that either side's arguments totally hang together. I mean, on Elon's side, it's just, he seems pretty hypocritical, both because, Sam Altman and the OpenAI side say that, Elon's proposal before he left was he wanted to kind of fold OpenAI into Tesla and turn it into a for-profit venture himself. And so, they say the issue was not Elon was favored like openness, it's just Elon wanted to be in control. And they said, no, he walked. But then on the OpenAI side, I think Elon's critique does have some merit, that if the reason you started this organization is you're afraid that super powerful AI is going to pose a threat to humanity, It's not clear that raising a bunch of money and developing the technology as fast as possible is really the right response to that. And it's just not clear like how that's a something that's in the public interest. So I think you have two guys with very big egos, both of whom kind of want to control the future of this technology and like to like frame their activities in an altruistic frame, but it's not clear to either of them are actually doing things that are going to be good for the world if you accept this frame that the AI is really this existential threat to people.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I never bought the original rationale of openness. And, the idea was AI is going to be this super dangerous thing. You can't leave it in the hands of only one entity. And Elon had a particular kind of tension with the people at Google over this because he had had some kind of argument with Larry Page at a party, I think. Yeah. And Larry, by somebody's account, Larry Page had acted as if it's okay if AI takes over the whole show, and to worry about the continued thriving of humankind is to be speciesist or something. And
that's Elon's account. Yes,
that's Elon's account. Right. And they say they didn't want the power concentrated. Okay, fine. But on the other hand, the model they seemed to embrace at the time, complete openness, and there's been some controversy over whether they meant open source, but there is a document in here that I found somewhere where Sam Altman is using the phrase open source in 2015. In any event, there was going to be tremendous transparency in terms of the scientific papers they produce and so on, which lately I would say there really hasn't been. But I didn't get to me, the completely untrammeled and as rapid as possible diffusion of this stuff is kind of scary in its own right. And it's funny, I came across, I forget what the link to this was, an interview in 2015 with both Sam Altman and Elon, conducted by Stephen Levy. And he raises the question of like, well, what about if Dr. Evil gets a hold of this or something? And it really kind of seems like they haven't really thought it through. I mean, they haven't really thoroughly thought through the bad actors problem, for example. But in any event, that was their original model, which I didn't totally get. And maybe that doesn't matter because they've definitely departed from it, right? I mean, it's like, there's this line in this interview about, and maybe I can probably track it down pretty quickly. From Altman saying, Altman in 2015, but it will just be open source, that's their version, and usable by everyone instead of usable by, say, just Google. Anything the group develops will be available to everyone. And then later he says, well, this is the bad actors thing. But he says, we will not use it the way Google would somewhere. And I don't know what they're doing now that's any different from what Google is doing, except like fewer black Vikings or something. Did the original idea make sense to you?
No,
as
not
an
really.
Idealistic thing?
No, not really. It depends what your premise is. I mean, if you buy this premise that this thing is going to be super dangerous, especially the first version of it is going to be super dangerous, then I think the only like coherent position is Alyosha Yudkowsky's position that we should just like stop developing this technology. Like that is a totally like internally consistent position. But the best spin you can put on it is, okay, somebody's going to build this stuff. And so you want the good guy to build the stuff and everybody thinks they're the good guy. And so, these OpenAI people are, probably maybe as responsible as anybody else. So it wasn't like a crazy thing, but also I think Larry Page has been a relatively good actor, all things considered. So I don't know if you think Google is going to be the first one to get it, I don't know that adding OpenAI to the mix is going to help. And I don't know that the open source thing kind of seems like a non sequitur. Like I agree. Like if you think this stuff is dangerous, probably you don't want it to be open sourced. And I think there was, so OpenAI did release an internal email from, early on around 2015, where Ilya Sutskever raises this and says, it might actually be dangerous. And so, we're going to be you know, open at the beginning, we might become less open over time as we get closer to AGI. And I think that's like totally reasonable, kind of given these premises. But like, I think one of the big like issues that's hung over this the whole time is there's this idea that we're going to do safety research or alignment research and like figure out how to make the AI safe. And so I guess that's the theory is we will develop as we'll get close to AGI so that we have a better idea what it'll be like. And that will then give us the information we need to figure out how to make the safe version of AGI. And I think because the like doomsday scenario is so poorly fleshed out, it's just like not clear what that work would look like, what a safety solution would look like. And so I think people have just been kind of stumbling around. So far, there's a super alignment team. So far, I have not found anything that they've published to be super, seems super helpful. But I think that's the basic problem. It's like nobody knows. A, nobody knows is it going to happen, but if it does, nobody knows what kind of technical work might make it better or worse. And so, I think nobody, the only like totally consistent position, if you think this is a problem, is we should like stop developing it. But obviously nobody wants to do that because they you know, wouldn't have a job anymore.
Yeah, I did a piece for the Non-Zero newsletter, a month or two ago called Sam Altman, Aspiring Messiah. And I was trying to figure out, like resolve this seeming paradox that he's, on the one hand, professes to be very concerned and has professed that at various times about superintelligence taking over something. And on the other hand, he's acting like an accelerationist, right? He's moving as fast as possible. And back to the Google comparison, I would say OpenAI is closer to moving fast and breaking things than Google has been with AI.
At least until last year, we can talk about that.
Yeah, but even the Black Vikings are, in a certain sense, a result of excessive caution, in a certain sense, and with certain ideological presuppositions, of course. But but you're also right. Yeah, Google is certainly moving faster under the competitive impetus of OpenAI. But anyway, in this piece, you know, I went back and looked at some of Altman's early blog things, and it becomes pretty clear that on the one hand, shortly months before OpenAI was founded, he is professing to be very concerned about superintelligence, and it seems to be a kind of Yudkowskyite scenario. This godlike thing could take over, bad news for all of us. And he says something, I think in another blog post, where it becomes clear, he says something like, it really matters who gets there first, right? Like who develops the superintelligence first. And the assumption there seems to be like, if it's a good guy, like that good guy will implant in the AI, like the magic alignment solution. And I think part of the problem is this assumption that there is a magic alignment solution, right? Like there's some key they're going to find that's going to render all future AI benign. And I mean, have you sensed this in certain people? And does it make sense to you?
I think the argument is, if you go back to Nick Bostrom's book, like the argument is the first one will become so powerful it can like shut down all the other ones. And so there's only going to be one. And so therefore you got to make sure that that first one is like, that doesn't seem very likely to me, but that, I think that's the argument, is the first one's going to take over the world. So if you accept that premise, then yeah, I guess it matters who the first one is.
But wouldn't the aligned one be so meek that ultimately it would fall prey to another less meek version? I mean, is it?
I mean, I don't know. Like, it seems very hypothetical to me, so it's a little hard to say. But no, I think the point about Google is a good one. Like, I think prior to about a year ago, Google had all this technology. They were treating it as a research thing. They were not releasing it. I don't know if that was for safety concerns versus kind of general bureaucracy or whatever. But you know, they were not. They were doing a lot of research and not deploying it in the world. And then OpenAI came along and produced this thing that impressed everybody. And very clearly it spooked Google, and they say, oh, you know, we need to start like getting this research we developed into the world. And I think in some sense you're right that the this like woke stuff was a result of them being overly cautious. But it's also like, I think if Google had, if the people in Google had their druthers, probably they would have liked to spend a few more months working on this and make that better. Mm-hmm. And it seems pretty clear there was a lot of pressure to like, we have to catch up to OpenAI. We can't let them like embarrass us by having the best LLM. And so I would assume that that's why this came out kind of half-baked is, and because you see this also in the way they released the release schedule. They, in December, they said, okay, we have this family of three models, but the most advanced one isn't ready yet, but we're going to publish our benchmark showing how amazing it is. And then in February, they released Gemini Ultra. And then a week later, they said, oh, we have Gemini 1.5. like no like marketing person would say like that's the way, right? You want to like you want to announce it when it's like ready to be used. You don't want to like announce the next thing a week later. It's just like it's very chaotic in a way that makes me think there's just they're under a lot of pressure to ship things and not very well organized. And I think that's part of why. And I think that's because they're under pressure from OpenAI. They don't want to be seen as like falling behind.
Yeah. Well, I you could raise questions about the branding of a lot of them. Claude 3s or 3 are called Opus, Sonnet, and Haiku, and it's like, wait, which is better? I think on the Google thing, you know, one interesting thing, you know, Sundar Pichai, people have been saying he should resign over the hyper wokeness thing or something. Ben Thompson, I think, said something like that. But you know, I have a question about Satya Nadella at Microsoft, who was like the darling of the tech press for the last few years. He thought he was doing a great job. One thing that came out in the OpenAI lawsuit is that the deal with Microsoft is that Microsoft gets the rights to use OpenAI stuff until it gets to the point of AGI, artificial general intelligence. Well, okay, but then it stipulates that the people who get to decide when it's reached AGI is the OpenAI board. Now, you would think in principle that that would leave Microsoft prey to, you know, I don't know. That doesn't seem like a great arrangement from Microsoft's point of view, especially now that the OpenAI board has changed hands and includes some, you know, arguably some more Machiavellian people. But that was a weird feature of the arrangement.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things we've seen in the last few months is that the structure of that deal gives Microsoft a lot of leverage because it's all using Microsoft infrastructure. Microsoft has a license to all this stuff. And they pledged this $10 billion, but they didn't write a $10 billion check. They're doling it out over time. I think some of it's probably like credit on Azure. And so like if for whatever reason, OpenAI, you know, evaporated or the board, you know, shut it down or whatever. I think Microsoft, what Nadella would tell his investors is, look, like we have the ability to just pick up where they left off and keep using the technology. Maybe they wouldn't get the new technology at the same rate, but any existing technology they have, they can keep using. And also it just gets, you know, ultimately, I think this is a play for their cloud product. It just gets people using their cloud infrastructure, which I think helps them. So, you know, it's definitely weird to invest $10 billion in a nonprofit organization where you have no like formal rights. But I think that they have structured in a way that Satya Nadella had this quote about OpenAI, that we're under them, we're above them, we're all around them, which is
Elon quotes that in the lawsuit.
Yeah. I think that like formally Microsoft doesn't have a lot of rights or a lot of influence, but informally, I think, as we saw when they had that big conflict with the board, clearly Microsoft, as long as they still have a big chunk of their like outstanding funding not yet paid, that gives them a lot of practical leverage, I think. And I think that Nadella just feels confident that that is sufficient to make sure he doesn't get kind of screwed in the deal.
That's probably true. And I suspect that AGI clause was kind of a fig leaf so that OpenAI could say, we're staying true to our ideals, right? As soon as this is OpenAGI, we're back to acting like a nonprofit or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
So what do you want to, anything else you want to say about that before we move on?
Should we talk a little bit more about the woke, like diversity aspect of Gemini?
Yeah, I mean, my take on that is, yeah, they didn't handle it super well. And we can talk about why. And I think on the one hand, the kind of some people on the right have mischaracterized it, as being some anti-white plot. I don't think that's kind of the origin of it. And I think to some extent, you have to give Google the leeway of, you know, recognizing that there is a difficult problem that they have to confront, that all these people have to confront, like on the diversity front. You know, it's like, obviously Vikings should be depicted as white because they were, but in more broadly, You know, when you say depict a bunch of college students or depict a bunch of, you know, people skateboarding or whatever, how should you handle that? And basically, on that front, distortion is everywhere. You look at the website of almost any college camp, college, and you'll see these students sitting around on a lawn, just a picture of ethnic diversity. You go to that college and look at a bunch of students sitting around a lawn. They're probably not that diverse, right? And the question arises, like, well, should you, when you project these images, should they be our ideal, like what we hope society will become, or should they be the reality? Well, All kinds of people err on the side of the ideal in terms of what they actually depict, commercials on TV and so on. So, and then and the
also,
question...
Also, people disagree about what the ideal is, right? I mean, that's the kind of totally. Liberal ideal, and there's some conservatives that are like, we don't actually want rapid demographic changes, so that's not our ideal. But yeah, and I think, like, organizations that are targeting like a specific audience can be more adapt about this is our audience, like this is what our audience is going to see. And these models are like for everybody. And so, you know, Google, I think, and I think part of it is like until, you know, a few months ago, the only people paying attention to this was a pretty self-selected group of AI people, which included like a, you know, AI ethics, diversity kind of, there's a community of people who are very worried about harms from discrimination by AI, which is a legitimate issue. I mean, one of the problems that there's been a lot of writing about is that like facial recognition systems are not as good at detecting black faces, in part, I think, because the training sets are skewed white. So like there are very legitimate issues here. But I think Google's experience until like last year was anytime there was criticism of their AI systems in this realm, it was always from the left. It was always people saying you're not doing enough to promote diversity. And so they wanted to like be careful, quote unquote. And so they'll kind of turn the dial as far as they could towards, well, make sure that like that side of the political spectrum doesn't criticize them. And people on the other side of the political spectrum is just a different demographic. They have different interests. And so they weren't like really worrying about these kind of in the weeds issues. But then once they produced, they like released this big, you know, like product intended for a mass market, now they really are paying attention. And like it was like so skewed that now a bunch of people on the right are mad at them. And yeah, I just think they didn't think it through very carefully or really do the amount of testing they should have.
You're going to get hit from one side or the other, no matter what you do. And I do think the way this is naturally going to lead to more like echo chamber AI in the sense that, you know, Google has enough information about the average user or can pretty readily acquire it. To tailor the images to what that person is going to like, right? And I think that's probably where we're headed. And when you get into really explicitly ideological realms, like what opinions they're showing them and stuff, if they want to, you know, minimize friction and maximize engagement, you know, it may be social media all over again.
Yeah.
And I almost don't see how that doesn't naturally happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Although I do think one of the big questions with these tools is totally clear what they're useful for. I mean, they're new enough that people like screwing around with them. And when you give somebody a new tool, one of the first things they think about is, oh, can we like get it to like give me, you know, controversial opinions? But I think in a couple of years, like asking it to generate, you know, various groups of people and seeing what the demographics are, I think people might just stop being interested in that. And so I think if you just do so, you actually see with OpenAI, you know, over the months I've been, you know, kind of checking in with what ChatGPT does. And it's become more more liberal in terms of the things it'll do. Like if you ask it to praise Hitler, it'll say no. But if you ask it to praise kind of like less famous dictators or like, you know, Republicans or like kind of semi-controversial people, it's more willing to do that than it was a few months ago. And I think they have gotten to what I think is the correct opinion, which for the most part, you should just do what the user asks and people need to get over it. I think it, to some extent, it's just like when these things are new, there's a lot of scrutiny. And so people are kind of sensitive. But it might kind of just shake out that like mostly people are using this for other things that are not controversial. And they just kind of have to ride it out and maybe people will chill out in the long run.
So when you say OpenAI's got or ChatGPT's got more liberal, you mean in kind of the 19th century sense of the word. I mean, you don't mean more left. You mean freer in what it will allow you to explore.
Yeah. So like if you write like for a while, I think if you asked it to write a poem praising Donald Trump, it would say, no, I can't do that because he's too controversial. Mm-hmm. And now it definitely will. And that's partly like pressure from Republicans. But I also think it's just like generally like they have gotten more comfortable with if you just do what the user asks, like mostly it's going to be fine.
Yeah. Yeah. That wouldn't surprise me. But these companies are going to be getting into trouble forever.
Absolutely.
Should we talk about some of the new? The Gemini, there was some good news about Gemini that got buried. Well, both it got buried by the Hyperwoke controversy, but also some people thought that OpenAI released their news about the Sora video thing to squash Google's announcement about its million token context window, right? And you have like views on that, right? So maybe you should, in case there's anybody who doesn't know what the significance of a context window is, like explain that.
Sure. So any large language model, it has a certain number of tokens, basically words that it can remember. And so when they launched the original ChatGPT, I think it had an 8,000 word token window, which is like maybe 10 pages of text. And so if you gave it like a 20 page document or a novel or something, it would just forget everything except the last 8,000 tokens. And so if you asked a question about like what was happening at the beginning of this document, it just wouldn't be able to answer it because it wouldn't have that in information. And so over time, these models have had longer and longer context windows. Currently, Claude has 200,000 and the best version of ChatGPT has 128,000 tokens.
Is the ratio of tokens to words something like 2-to-1 or something? I mean, a million tokens is how many words?
It's like 3/4 of a word. It's basically a word.
So it's like maybe 800,000 words in this million token context window.
Exactly. Yeah. Because it's like a short word is just a token. A long word might be 2 or 3 tokens.
Okay.
It's a few letters. And yeah, so it's say 750, 800,000 words. And so that is enough for like a 1,000-page novel or something. And so this is important for a few ways. So one of the things they saw with the like 100,000 token context windows is they could accept that many tokens, but they still seem to kind of forget the information in the early part. Like if you would ask it a question about something near the beginning of its context window, it would still be a little less likely to remember it. And so Google both has pushed this out to a million, but they also say they've gotten much better at this kind of recall problem. So it really can attend to a full million. And so there's a couple of reasons I'm interested in this. One is that just from an engineering perspective, the way that these models work, they don't have any sort of ability to abstract or summarize. So like if you read a whole novel and I ask you like what happened on the like fourth page, you might be able to give me a summary of what happened in the first chapter, but you're not going to be able to like recite like word for word. And these language models don't have any, you have like your brain like builds like an abstract model of like, here were the major plot points, here were the characters and stuff. Whereas language models just remember the exact every word. And this makes them very computationally inefficient for very large sequences because it's going back and it's thinking about every single previous token every time it generates a new token. And so anyway, Google, it seems like they may have solved this, and so that's important from a technical perspective. But then this could open up some significant new applications because it will allow them to do more complex kind of tasks. So like one example they had is they had an obscure language I forget, some like small island or something where there were just a few hundred speakers. And so they had almost no examples to train a model on, but they had basically a dictionary and a grammar guide. And they put, the whole thing was like, you know, it was like a small book. They put that, and then they put some text to translate, and they found it could translate it quite well. And so there are, there are problems. Okay, rather than having it just like edit, say, a single file in a computer program, you could have a whole software project with like dozens of different, pieces of code, and you could just give it the whole thing and say, now do this. So it could just increase the, could dramatically increase the like, types of problems that these language models can work on. I think why this is important.
An obvious thing would just be put a book in, put Nick Bostrom's book Superintelligence in, which probably isn't a super long book anyway, but and ask questions like, what does he say about this? What does he say about that? Presumably the answers would be pretty reliable. I guess they don't go back. They don't give you, would they give you page citations?
It depends. I mean, it'll be just like, it wouldn't have pages per se. But yeah, potentially it could tell you like where to look, or it could you could ask it to give, you know, a quote, and then you could like just do a keyword search shift to find that particular section. You know, that would depend on kind of how it was implemented. I guess the other reason is this is interesting is because of the thing I was saying before, where the classic transform architecture kind of gets slower and slower as the context window gets smaller. Mm-hmm. If Google somehow fixed that and it can go much further than a million, like one of the classic problems that a lot of people are using large language models are for is, say you're a corporation, you've got like 100,000 documents, you know, product manuals or, you know, trouble ticket requests or something. People are building all these like complicated kind of search systems to, it's called retrieval augmented generation, where they'll do like a keyword search or a vector search and grab like the most relevant documents and stick it in the LLM's context window and then answer a question. But you could get to a point where the corporation can just dump like an entire database of whatever into the context window and have a much simpler architecture where you can just give it, or like your email, if you want to search through your email. Right now, there's no way to really have it like read through all your emails and ask questions about it. But you could have a future if there's a, you know, 100 million token context window, you could just give it your entire email, like every email you've, you know, read or received, written or received from the last 10 years and ask it. So it could really, change the set of applications that we're doing. And the thing I was surprised was I was thinking there'd be kind of an upper limit because this like doesn't scale well. So it's interesting. I'll be interested to see kind of what the pricing is like and, you know, if they're able to continue scaling it up beyond a million.
Now, Claude says that they are going to have, as part of Claude 3, eventually a million token context window as well, right?
Yeah. So the version they released is 200,000, and they said, like, contact us if you need more than that. And so I think that puts them kind of a parity with Google, because Google hasn't released the million context window either. They say they have it. They say it's coming in the future, but it's not available to the public yet.
I have a question about the Google thing. So I keep hearing the million tokens is going to be available in the Gemini Pro 1.5. And this gets back to how bad all the branding is. I pay for Gemini Advanced. I think I pay as much as anyone can pay, $20 a month.
Yeah.
Presumably, I should be entitled to this, but I don't think what I have is Gemini Pro. I mean, what is Gemini Pro?
So Pro is the less advanced. So there's Pro and there's Ultra. Ultra is more advanced than
this
Pro.
This makes no sense. What is and so, this makes no sense.
No,
this
I, is, I
they're giving the million, they're putting the best context.
Well,
window.
No, I think the idea is I think there will eventually be a 1.5 Ultra, which will have the million.
Which is also
window.
Advanced, and, by the way. Pay attention. Ultra became advanced. And pro, right. But don't confuse them with Pro.
So,
which, of
so
course,
think,
being the cheaper thing gets the better shit. Okay, you got all that?
No, so I think I agree. It's a confusing. So the Pro versus the Ultra is the model. And then Advanced versus not Advanced is the app, the chatbot. In the same way that you have GPT-4 is the model and ChatGPT is the app.
Yeah.
Is the product that you pay for. And so Gemini Advanced just means the version of Gemini that gets the best thing that's available. And so I assume when 1.5 Pro is available, you'll get it under Advanced. And then when 1.5 Ultra comes, which is will presumably be a long context window that's better than Pro, you'll get that. But yes, I agree. It's like very confusing. Mm-hmm. And like, I think one of the issues they're having is that like, there's not like just a wide range. There's a big trade-off between amount of compute and performance. And so as they throw more and more compute at it, it gets more and more expensive to do these models. And so, like, you see with ChatGPT, there's GPT-4 is powerful and expensive, 3.5 is less powerful and less expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And that gap is just widening, where they can make cheaper and cheaper models that is kind of, like, similar to the original ChatGPT, and then more and more powerful models. And so, if they just release, they need to release multiple models to kind of fit, like, what different people need. And so, that's why there's these different versions. And it's just, if you look at the pricing page, I think the most powerful version of Claude is like 60 times more expensive than the cheapest version. And you know, so for many people building practical applications, they'll use the cheaper version for the stuff that doesn't require the power, the more powerful one. But for a consumer, it kind of you just want the most powerful one because, like, you know, you're paying for it.
Yeah. I was talking to a guy last night who runs, you know, kind of a small business, has been a customer of Google Cloud, has done AI stuff on Google Cloud. And they have little, you know, relatively small, but generic neural networks they're trying to train. And he said they can't get the compute time with Google Cloud. He says, like, maybe if they like, you know, schemed and offered more money or something, they could. But it sounds like you know, there's really kind of a backup. It's just amazing. And I wonder, you know, does that reflect hype? Does that reflect all of these companies thinking they're going to do great things and all of these startups thinking they're going to do great things and they're mostly going to fail and then the bottleneck will be over? Or what's your sense?
I mean, we'll see. Certainly it reflects people think that these things are going to be amazing. And like, I think you have a lot of, I think there's been enough hype that a lot of companies feel they need to have an AI play. And so right. I think that has kind of multiplied the amount. Just there's a lot of like Fortune 500 companies that don't have anything particular to do, but just feel they need an AI product. And so then they are all like stampeding to get computers. So there's a general shortage. In terms of if it's like, this is like a bubble that's going to pop. I mean, I'm getting a little more, I'm starting to lean a little more in that direction. I mean, probably just because seeing we now have two rivals to GPT-4. And for my testing, it seems like Gemini is not quite as good as ChatGPT, and Claude is like roughly at parity with GPT-4. But like, it's been a year since GPT-4 came out. And if it were the case that, especially Google, like Google has more compute than anybody else in the world. If it was the case you could just throw more compute at the problem and get better performance, I would have expected Gemini to be at least a little bit, maybe a lot better than GPT-4. And it seems like they like did their best and got just like the same as GPT-4. And so that makes me think, like, I don't know, I mean, I'm sure there will be further progress, but I don't think we're going to see the kind of exponential progress we saw as we went from GPT-2 to 2 to 3 and from 3 to 4. And and it seems like the current large language models, it's not clear to me they're super useful for a lot of the things people are talking. Like, I think a lot of the investment right now is based on the assumption there's going to be further rapid progress, and so we'll sort of be, you know, they'll be ready when GPT-5 or whatever comes out, and that might happen. But I'm becoming a little more skeptical of that. I think in the long run, I still think like AIs, you're going to see more progress, but I think they might need to come up with new architectures or new approaches that might take a few more years, and so you might see the LLMs run out of steam a little bit, and we might have, you know, at least GPTs be much more plentiful in a year or two.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, I got to think there's got to be a stock market correction with the chip stocks and the big tech company stocks. But I think the thing itself is for real, personally.
Well, I mean, I do think, like, again, I think it's worth distinguishing the transformer architecture, current generation of LLMs. I mean, there were a lot of people a year ago who literally just thought if you take the, you know, 175 billion GPT 3.5 and you scale up to, you know, a trillion or 10 trillion or whatever, that like will just kind of mechanically get you to like quote unquote AGI, or you like a, you know, much higher level performance. And I think what we're seeing is that like these large language models are getting better and better at certain things. You know, they can form complete sentences and they can do certain kinds of verbal reasoning. But like, so in my article, I showed her the picture of some apples and said, how many apples are there? And it just has no clue. And that has not improved in the last year. If you do also basically like spatial reasoning things, you know, I asked it to do a maze, it couldn't do like even a very simple maze. And so I think that, so that's one example. I think just spatial reasoning is not something these large language models can do, because there's no like structure. It doesn't have an internal like model, any way of modeling like the like physical relationships among things. And so I think no matter how much computing power you're going to throw at it, like, that's just not the kind of thing that this model is going to do. And so you're going to need some other model. I'm sure there is some model that can do it, and eventually they'll invent it.
Well,
but it's going to take some additional work that's my prediction.
I would think, now there's also the problem, this was also in your piece, of telling time. They're not very good. You show it a clock, it's not good at telling you what time
it is. Analog clock, yeah.
But at the same time, and this gets to something we were going to talk about anyway, which is like, what is the structure of the human mind? Is it a general purpose intelligence and learning machine, or is it actually consist more of these kind of specialized modules? I tend to think the latter, as you know, most people in evolutionary psychology do, I think. But say the clock thing, you could train, I assume, with existing models. If the input is pictures of a bunch of different kinds of clocks and the output is the correct time, you can train it right? I mean, you could come up with a model that was just good at telling time, and already they're starting to use these so-called mixture of experts models where kind of the query comes in or whatever, and the system farms it out to a kind of a specialized AI that's good at doing a particular thing. And I think that's where this is ultimately headed, and I don't I don't understand. It's not clear to me what kinds of problems can't be solved in principle through machine learning, you know, of a very specialized kind. And maybe this becomes like a little module in the system, but it just seems to me a lot of these problems are in principle soluble, right?
So I think it's a question of, I think, of scale. So if you were to say, okay, we're just going to make a LM, like we're going to take an LM architecture and just train it on pictures of clocks. Mm-hmm. I think if you scaled it up enough so that it had a photo of like every single possible configuration of clocks, it could like memorize that when the clock goes in exactly, that our hand goes in exactly this direction and the hour minute hand goes in exactly that direction, that that's this time. And it could like memorize every single possible position. Mm-hmm. But obviously, like, that's not how people do it, right? We understand the hour clock, the hour hand has a certain meaning, the minute has a certain meaning. Mm-hmm. And what we do is we say, this is the direction it's pointing. We have some concept of direction. And then we do a little bit of like mental math to say when it's hours this way, right? We have that. And like, right. And the way, I think that the way that this particular architecture works, where it's kind of token oriented, it like splits the image up. The way it works under the hood is it like splits the image up into little patches and it has like a token to represent each patch. There's no like concept of this hand is pointing in a particular direction, because that's like a spatial thing. And so, I mean, another example of this is if you ask it for directions, if you say, like, give me directions from the White House to Dulles Airport, it will give you, like, roughly the right sequence of streets. It'll know you're supposed to go on I-66 and K Street and stuff like that. But the right versus left is basically a coin flip. It makes no, there's no, like, rhyme or reason to it. And that's because, again, there's, like, you need a certain kind of data structure that knows, okay, if you turn two rights, or three rights, that's the same as a left. And like, this is up and this, right? There's like, again, it's like when you're thinking of in terms of word vectors, there's just no like simple mapping from a word vector to, you know, like the spatial organization of a map. And so like, obviously I can't prove you that this is definitely not going to happen, but it seems like as they've improved, other stuff has improved, but it's just like, it's not even, counting is another thing where I think it can, as you go from GPT-3 to GPT-4, GPT-3 can like count to five, count up to like five objects, and four can count to like 10. But you're not going to scale up by like five more orders of magnitude, so now it can count to 50 or something, right? Because the counting, you need like a counter. You need some like variable that you're counting as you're going along, and there's no, right? So there's just certain data structures that you need. You need certain data structures, and this very simple thing of like everything's a word vector and you're finding correlations between vectors. I think there's just certain relationships, you need some other data structure to do that. I just don't think the transformer has all those data structures.
And this gets at the question of, you know, to what extent will these things have to be supplemented with, you know, formal logic programs and symbol manipulation?
Yeah. This is why I think the brain's an interesting analogy, right? Because like the brain, like when I recognize a face, there's like specific kind of circuitry behind my eye. Right. That has, I'm not an expert on how this works, but like it's doing a very specific thing. There actually are we have neural networks for image recognition that have a kind of analogous thing, but it's not based on viewing images as like a sequence of tokens. It's a different thing. And so I think you're just going to have, I don't know how many of those, if you need three or five or 20 or something.
So you're saying facial recognition results from, well, machine learning, but not involving transformers. I mean, network, but it doesn't involve transformers.
Yeah. And I don't actually know if these transformer-based networks, how good they are at like facial recognition for like individual people. I think if they had that ability, probably these big companies wouldn't do that because it's kind of creepy. But I think it might be the case that different models that are specific, because I think the facial recognition ones are actually based on like figuring out like the geometry of the face, like how far apart are your eyes and stuff, which is not something. Anyway, so I think it's very possible that no matter how much you train a transformer, it's not going to be as good at recognizing faces as one of these models that's like specifically optimized for facial recognition that has a different shape to it.
I mean, that might be more like the teaching it how to tell time thing, if you were not going to use some kind of formal logic to teach it to tell time. I mean, it might be that, it's not an LLM per se, no transformers. I mean, I don't know what I'm talking about, so I'll stop. But there is this interesting question related with Sora, the video thing. Which, I mean, I want to say, first of all, about Sora is like, so it's the thing where with a text prompt generates strikingly lifelike video that, if you look closely, doesn't always comply precisely with the text prompt. And mm-hmm. also, if you look closely, has weird glitches in it. All yeah. that said, I still think that what that portends is the day in 5 years or 10 years or whatever, when you put on the virtual reality goggles, which will be much more lightweight than they are now, and say, I want to be in a world where blank, and mm-hmm. you're there.
Yeah.
And the other thing I want to say is, at that point, you are halfway to the Matrix, buddy. That's how they put us to sleep, Tim. Yeah. Don't put on the goggles. That's how yeah. that's how the superintelligence is going to put us to sleep.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think you had Gary Marcus on a few weeks ago, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
and you guys were arguing about do these models like really understand? And I feel like this debate has gotten polarized in kind of an unhelpful way, where there's some people who are kind of skeptics, like I think Gary Marcus, who just say these models, what they do is not at all like human understanding. They don't understand something. It's just a stochastic parrot, blah, blah, blah. And then people on the other side who are like, no, if you just like turn the crank enough times, like you're going to get to AGI. And I think it's like neither of those things. Like, I think that actually like what people think about as general intelligence is actually a bundle of like different abilities, and that LLMs really are understanding things, but they're understanding kind of a one like domain of, you know, the verbal mm-hmm. domain, which is probably roughly corresponds to like what like one part of our brain does. But there's other things that we do with other parts of our brain that maybe LLMs are never going to be able to do. And if we want to eventually have human level AI, what we'll need is kind of corresponding models for what other parts of our brain, some of which we might already have, and we just need to kind of glue together, maybe some of which we need to invent. But it's like not, anyway, I don't think either the kind of Gary Marcus position or the EAC position that we just, you know, we'll
the accelerationist.
Just kind of, yeah. Yeah. The like scale is all you need kind of view. I don't think either of those is likely to be correct.
Yeah. I mean, the other relevant thing about Sora to this whole conversation is there are some people saying that. So what it seems to have been, you know, the training there seems to be like you show it a bunch of videos and you show it a bunch of corresponding text prompts that describe the videos.
Right.
And it learns how to make the connection. Now, the way it chops up the videos, I still don't get. Apparently, there's something called patches that are analogous to tokens. And whereas I can kind of half understand the way the LLMs work with tokens, I really don't get the way this patches thing works. Anyway, that is yeah. supposedly the analogy.
Yeah.
But the interesting question is, in learning, you know, there's a whole controversy over to what extent do the large language models in learning how to, okay, granted, they're kind of just mimicking conversation and paraphrasing things they've heard online, granted, but still, that's not nothing, right? To paraphrase something, you have to understand the meaning of it, at least humans do. And in right. fact, it is the case that LLMs did develop a system for representing the meaning of words, which I personally am kind of blown away by. Some people aren't, but there's a whole controversy
yeah, absolutely.
about how deep kind of the conceptual representations they're coming up with are, because we really don't know what exactly is going on in the middle of these. And there's a similar question about Sora. There are people who think that that this AI, in order to do what Sora does, is starting to build a representation of what you might call intuitive physics. In other words, not the equations of Newton, but just understanding that most stuff tends to stay where it is. And if something's moving, it tends to keep moving, which is kind of like Newton. But anyway, things fall down and not up and so on. And also a sense for how certain animals move and all of that. You know, somewhere in our brains, there are structures that allow us to kind of take all that for granted and work with the visual representation of the world we have. And there are people who think that that's what's being built inside Sora. Right.
Yeah. So I think this is actually, I think there is a close analogy here. I mean, if you look at, so a couple of things people have noticed about Sora, there was one video that had a group of people on the beach that were like taking a chair out, and the chair like moved kind of in some weird ways. But one of the things people noticed is for a while you had six people in the scene, and then one of the people walked behind another person and like disappeared, and that person was no longer right. there. You also, I think, had some animals that had like an ant with like four legs instead of six, and a cat that like anyway so those kind of things were like knowing how many of something there should be. It's bad in the same way that like image models are bad at like drawing fingers, mm-hmm. right? They'll have too many hands or go in the wrong direction. And I think that's because these models tend to do, they tend to do pattern matching on like a local basis. So like you said, if an object is moving, it'll continue moving. And so if you have, you know, a ball in one frame, it's here, and the next frame it's over, it'll know that it should continue going. But it doesn't have this is something I think Gary Marcus, there's something to what he's saying. It doesn't have this underlying model that, okay, there's like five balls in this scene, and if this ball occludes the other ball, it needs to like come out on the other side. Because once it like disappears from, it doesn't have like a deeper like structure to it. It only is reasoning from the current frame to the next frame. And people are kind of keeping track when we watch the video. We're keeping track. Okay, there were five people in that frame. What happened to the, you know, the fifth person? Why did that person disappear? Or, you know, this cat should have the same number of legs throughout the video. And it's so far, I mean, again, maybe it'll this ability will improve over time, but it seems sort of similar to the way that like these models can't count how many apples there are in a picture. It's good at if you focus on a specific thing, it can tell kind of the relationship of the things next to it. But if you kind of have a global view of like how many objects are there or things like that, it doesn't have the right kind of data structure to keep track of that necessarily.
Okay. So listen, we've reached the point where we move into overtime. Paywall comes up. We encourage people to stick around. To do that, you have to become a paid subscriber to the Non-Zero newsletter, or are you going to post this on your thing?
Audio? Probably not. I think
probably not. Okay. Then do not give your money to Tim. Although there is a paid version of his newsletter that's worth
it. Yes. There are a lot of great articles.
But if all you want is to watch the rest of this video or audio, as the case may be, I'm afraid you have only one choice. Yes. And that's to become a paid subscriber, Non-Zero newsletter. In any event, you can also become a supporter of either by just becoming a subscriber of any kind if you're not. And we encourage that. Rate and review us both. Say good things or say nothing. Smash the like button and so on. Anything else you want to plug, Tim, before we...
No, let's do it.
Okay, so thanks to everybody. We're heading into overtime.